Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Well, we are rapidly approaching the 250th birthday of our nation, a good time to reflect on the state of our union and on what it will take to make it another 250 years. Things are looking pretty dicey these days, actually. We are engaged in a literal hot civil war, the country torn apart by divisive forces seeking to dismantle, deconstruct, and destroy the values, the institutions, the way of life, the iconic historic figures, the Christian faith, and the exceptionalism that once made us the greatest nation in history and the preeminent world superpower. So, we're at a precarious point, a turning point, you might say, beyond which America will be either great again or a failed experiment. A lot of people aren't optimistic. One way we can ground ourselves in a hopeful perspective on the future, however, is by taking inspiration from the past, specifically from the courageous, brilliant, committed patriots who constituted our founding fathers and who pledged their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor by carefully crafting and signing the Declaration of Independence, the bold, unique, historic document of freedom wherein we listed our grievances against the mother country that had become our oppressor and announced to the world that we were establishing a new and independent state. In today's episode, I'm going to be talking with a guest whose new book has a great deal to tell us about those founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence, what it meant to Americans 250 years ago, and what it means for us today. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture has just an insane resume. He is a professor and graduate school dean at the awesome Hillsdale College. He oversees a Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship at Hillsdale's D.C. campus. He was the executive editor of the President's 1776 Commission. He was vice president of American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's a fellow at the Claremont Institute. I honestly don't know how he fits all this on his business card. He's the author of, among other things, the book We Still Hold These Truths, and now of an important new book called The Making of the American Mind, The Story of Our Declaration of Independence. Matthew Spaulding, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to have you. Dr. Spaulding, this book, well, first let me say it's a beautiful book. Encounter makes gorgeous.
Thank you.
Encounter makes gorgeous books, and I think that matters. A book, I think, should be a thing of beauty and a visual and physical pleasure to sit down with. Sorry for that digression. My first impression.
No, I agree. We had great material to work with. It's a beautiful subject, so we wanted a beautiful book to go with it. So thank you for that.
My first impression was that the title had some kind of a resonance with Alan Bloom's classic book, The Closing of the American Mind.
Right.
So I thought there might be some connection there, but that's not really it, is it? The title actually derives from Thomas Jefferson's description of the Declaration of Independence. Could you tell us about that?
No, that's right. Now, my guess is that's where Alan Bloom got his title from, The Closing of the American Mind. But the reference here is to a letter that Jefferson writes. As you know, towards the end of his life, you're approaching the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, and he's written a letter asking about the writing of it and what it meant and all of that kind of thing. And he writes back this, it's his wonderful letter to Henry Lee in 1825. And he writes back this letter, which I think is very telling and actually is of central importance to my book and our reading of the Declaration, which is that, look, I didn't mean to invent new ideas here. I didn't make things up. It wasn't intended to be that. It was intended to be an expression of the American mind and be written in a tone appropriate for the occasion. He basically was saying what he was doing, which was saying he was the draftsman, he was the penman, he was chosen by a committee and we can get into that process and all of that. Jefferson's very important. Jefferson's a beautiful writer, mm-hmm. but he very self-consciously always understood himself to be the drafter of a document expressing the American mind, which is not Thomas Jefferson's mind, not John Locke's mind, whatever it might be, but the American mind,
yeah.
Which say all those pamphlets and the debate and what was going on in the Continental Congress. And I took that for the title of my book because that's actually the point here. This is not merely a one-off document. It's not a specifically Jeffersonian document, although Jefferson is very important. It's not merely that. It was a very talented writer in the heat of a moment in a legislative chamber, in a committee, in the lawmaking process, in the heat of imminent war, expressing what the American mind believed about what they wanted to do and what they foresaw and what they were going to do. And so I took that as my book title because I think that actually expresses what the Declaration is.
Yeah.
It's that expression of the American mind.
Yeah. Well, as you noted, we are rapidly approaching the 250th birthday of our nation, so this book couldn't be more timely. But the story of our Declaration has been told before. Why did you feel compelled to address it again, and what's different about yours?
A good question. The particulars were that is the anniversary we're now beginning. But also, I wanted to allow the document to tell its own story. You know, there are lots of things been written on it. Some of them, they're very good, in my opinion. But I wanted to do something different,
yeah.
Which is say I wanted to write the story. And so the first part of the book is really a lot about how it was physically created and the events and George Washington, what was going on at the time and the debate in the Continental Congress. But then I wanted to do something different. I wanted to let the document itself tell its own story. You know, we probably all can recite maybe the famous lines and are familiar with that when we hear it read.
Yeah.
But it's very rare that we actually look at the document as a whole and work our way through it phrase by phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to do, because when you do that, you get a different story. You get a fuller story. You really figure out, you really have a deep sense of what they were up to, what they were doing. And it draws us to different conclusions and is quite, makes that story all the more powerful. And so I treat it like that. And early in the book, I kind of make the reference to it. It's like a symphony, right? There are different movements, there are different parts and different little sub-themes here and there, but it's overall a whole symphony. You have to think about it as that whole.
Yeah.
And when you do, it's a very delightful, powerful, powerful story. And it really is the central act of the great drama of the founding. So that's the story I wanted to tell.
Yes. What was it about this document that set Americans apart, not only from what it calls our British brethren, but from other peoples historically?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things that make this very different here. And generally speaking, the founding itself, the way America begins is different than any other country, and that's because of this particular document. It's clearly rooted in history. It makes all sorts of historical references once you started getting into it. But it does something very different that had never been done before, which is why I've always been attracted to it, but also why American history has always been attracted to it. And every president has been attracted to it, and our politics turn on it. And you know, Lincoln eloquently speaks about it. It's a touchstone of our politics. Think of Martin Luther King, Calvin Coolidge, famously, you know, the founders themselves. It's because it does something different and perhaps unexpected, which is say that it's a you know, they famously pass independence on July 2nd, and then they spend 2 days editing this document.
Yeah.
There was no need to do that. They could have merely passed a one-sentence statement that they had declared their independence. But they did something different. They wrote it all out. They wrote out a beautiful document. They spent a lot of time editing it very closely.
Yes.
because they wanted to do something else as well, which is say that it does separate these colonies from England. We divide from our British brethren, as you said, which is an interesting point in and of itself, right? We declare ourselves, we announce that we're a people. But the other thing they do, very clearly in the Declaration, it's several times, this thematic is constant there, is whenever they talk about separating, they're also talking about creating. And they're creating a new nation. And they're creating a new nation not based on all the old European canards and aristocracy and ethnicity and monarchy and this kind of thing, but they're going to ground this new nation on what are actually some very old ideas, radically old ideas, meaning as in going back to the root, that we are all equal in a deep, fundamental way, which really kind of grows out of the ancient tradition, especially once you get into the Romans and that whole tradition of nature and understanding man.
Yeah.
But also fundamentally comes out of the Christian tradition. We are equal in the eyes of God. And so that's how we're going to start this nation. And it's audacious. It's really is radical. And they really put it all on the line in the heat of the moment. Because this has been going on for a number of years, this debate. And so they're thinking about this, They're very well educated and well read, and they know history, and they've thought about this a lot.
Yeah.
And the Declaration is basically kind of pulls all that together, which is why it's such a beautifully written document. Jefferson's this wonderful writer, but he pulls it all together in this very powerful statement.
I love how you break down the entire document in terms not only of the meaning of each sentence and section, sometimes individual words, but you've also related so many great, should we call them behind-the-scenes stories of the creation of the Declaration. Is there one that you find especially illuminating or compelling that the average American might not know about this process?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things I think the main thing we often forget and overlook. So usually when you study the history of the founding, you know what the Declaration of Independence, 1776. And then there's this Constitution some decade or so later, and there's this little thing in between called the Revolutionary War. But the biggest mistake that we and as a result of the history that we miss is We assume the Declaration is merely, they assign Jefferson to write it, he goes off in private and comes up with this and writes it all out. I give him credit for writing it, but it is heavily edited, it's heavily worked. Mm-hmm. When we think about it, just as Jefferson, we miss the larger story. The Continental Congress comes together, itself a thing of great historical important magnitude. It really is the precursor to the United States Congress. We come together as a Congress of colonies, and they debate and they argue at great length about everything. And there are these very, very, very powerful debates in the Continental Congress about whether or not we should have independence. John Adams is a massively important, heroic figure in that effort. And then they decide, if they're going to have a vote on independence, there's been a motion by Richard Henry Lee. They create a committee. The committee then goes off and it's breaks into a subcommittee essentially of Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and Jefferson. Jefferson's assigned to take the first draft of it. Mm-hmm. But then it comes back and it's edited heavily in the Continental Congress. So to get to my answer to your question, if we don't see the Declaration for what it is, which say it's this document that's created, it's written by, there's a draftsman, but then it's goes through this process of collective editing, and it's in the midst, it's a legislative document, it's passed by a legislature, it's a piece of law. Yeah. And there's back and forth and give and take and arguments and additions. The Continental Congress makes some very important additions to Jefferson's document. It cuts it by about a third. So that process itself, if we just merely see it as a Jeffersonian document, we miss that process. And we don't get the larger story, which is what transforms it into an expression of the American mind in its fullest sense. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. Everybody knows the phrase from the Declaration about our unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That last one especially is widely known, but I think widely misunderstood, isn't it? Tell us why the founders focused on the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me just back up a tiny bit just to give us a little bit more setup for that, because this is actually crucially important, which is, I always like to point out that the famous second paragraph, the one we all know, right, doesn't begin by saying, well, we have some personal views we'd like to share with you. It begins, we hold these truths to be self-evident. That is to say that it's a beginning point of this conversation has to be recognized that the founder's world, if you will, is essentially still kind of almost a pre-modern world in which it was understood, and this was kind of throughout the whole Greek and Roman tradition, the Christian tradition, that the mind was metaphysically free and could come to know things about reality. We hold these truths. There are truths, and some can be so powerful they are self-evident.
Yes.
And that's a setup to these points then, right? All men are created equal, and they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Then the line you've noted here, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So my first part of that answer is that these are not merely kind of subjective values.
Yeah.
Or kind of the shiny object of the day. These are what the founders understood using their reason and their understanding, their deliberation, their ability to grasp this reality. These are things they understood to be true in the very nature of things. Whether we understood that to be the natural law tradition or the kind of a general revelatory tradition of the Christian tradition. Point one is it's grounded in something.
Yes.
It's not really a frivolous claim. It's grounded in something. Okay, so that being the case, what can they possibly mean by the pursuit of happiness? Well, two things. One is they chose the phrase pursuit of happiness throughout the process. That was never questioned. They didn't say life, liberty, and property, which would have been the Lockean expression of the phrase, which is often pointed out. They didn't do that, and no one actually just argued that we should go back to that. So it's not that. The other thing that's very clearly not is it doesn't mean life, liberty, and their pursuit of whatever makes you feel good. They weren't so low-minded and small-minded to have that sense. They happiness had some substantive meaning. The phrase happiness goes back to the Greeks, right? It's the end of all politics from the classical tradition, and happiness continues as an end of man's life in the Christian tradition. Christianity does elevate that meaning of happiness, right? There is a happiness beyond this world, but happiness is the term of art, and so it just boggles the mind that. Jefferson and all the founders who edited this and keep it in there don't understand happiness to have substantive meaning. Indeed, all the other letters and writings around the Declaration, other statements by the Continental Congress, it's clear that it means a substantive happiness that's more akin to human flourishing. The other thing I point out is that, look, is there one thing that all the founders clearly understood to be the component of the pursuit of happiness at its height? Yes. It's our religious liberty. That is the pursuit of happiness was understood to be the pursuit of the things that make man fulfilled. And there's lots of room in that. It doesn't mean you can be, kind of go around killing people and doing clearly immoral and wrong things. But there's lots of room for different vocations. But one thing it does mean is that you do have a fundamental right to pursue your ultimate happiness as a component of that, which is why, even though it doesn't say so, the Declaration has always been understood, the founders always understood it to be pointing towards fundamentally the protection of religious liberty.
The Declaration ends with the signers pledging in support of the Declaration their lives, fortunes, and sacred honor. And sadly, we don't live in a time in which honor is valued very highly. But it's a reminder that the signers of this document really were risking everything. Why did they close this carefully crafted document with the term sacred honor?
Yeah, another great question. And I spent a lot of time on this one as well, because and what originally got me thinking about this is I'm always encouraged people go back and read the document again, read the whole thing. And, you know, it kind of builds up, makes all these arguments. There's a long discussion. The longest section is there about all the grievances against the king. And then this last paragraph is, if in law, right, this is kind of the money paragraph, right? We, therefore, the representatives, it's the formal Declaration of Independence. And the middle of that paragraph is actually Richard Henry Lee's motion. Everything's written kind of around that. But then there's this last sentence at the end, and it's a sentence on its own, and it comes after the formal declaration, which is to say it serves no formal purpose. I kind of had to think about that for a while. So what good does it do? It doesn't actually do anything. But what it does do, it's a very personal statement, right? For support of this declaration, with this reliance on on divine protection, we mutually pledge to each other. It's an oath they take among the signers to each other, and they pledge to each other their lives, their fortunes, and sacred honor. Now it's clearly, again, this is probably the most beautiful sentence of the document. Jefferson intends it to be it's parallelism, right? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Here it's lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. So the pursuit of happiness has changed to our sacred honor. So you can pledge your life. That's pretty straightforward, right? They're literally going to war. They can pledge our fortunes. Many of them lost their fortunes. I mean, their lives, their families, their homes, their physical fortunes, their ships, their money, right? But they can't pledge to each other our pursuit of happiness, because that's something that I pursue in my own life, my own soul, my own, intentions, directed towards my understanding of my vocation and the good I am pursuing. But you can pledge to each other your honor. And then when he says our sacred honor, Jefferson, that's kind of makes it electric. That's a, boom, that's just a great mic drop. It's honor in that, and he means it in the fullest sense of that word, which is not merely having a good reputation, right, but actually deserving that good reputation. You are honorable. You have the virtues, and deserve those to be recognized for those virtues. And then he adds this word sacred. It's not just honor in the classical sense, but it's honor that can be sacred before God. And it just kind of makes it, it's an electric ending to the whole document.
Well, speaking of sacred, you have a section toward the end called the theology of the Declaration. The religious sensibilities and motivations of the founders are always kind of a topic of heated debate. Can you sum up what you say in this section about the theology of the Declaration?
It kind of comes up throughout the book, and it's something that I think is actually it's unique and kind of goes. People have pointed out certain parts of this before, but really kind of goes beyond that. Which is when you do a very close read of it, you start to see other things, even more profound things. But in general, it's a pushback. First of all, it's a pushback against the kind of the normal interpretation. Or one of the dominant interpretations is that, look, the Declaration is really a secular document. it was meant to be a secular document and begin a secular nation that has no references. They're a bunch of deists and there's really nothing there. And that's just not the case when you spend time with the document. There are only two individual characters in the whole document. Both have absolute power. And one turns out, this is a spoiler alert, one turns out to be a tyrant, George III. But the other individual that's referred to throughout the document is God. God is very prominent in the document. Jefferson knew his audience, and he makes references that they're non-sectarian. They're not specifically Christian. This is not a New Testament Christian document. But having said that, there's a thick theology there, I think, that we can build on. God appears several times. He first appears as the laws of nature and nature's God, the God who creates nature and the laws of nature. Think of kind of in general revelation, right? There's this sense that we can, through our own reason, be able to see around us and instinctively understand that. Then this God turns out to be a creator of us, of human beings in particular. He creates us in such a particular form that he endows us in particular with rights, with certain rights, among which are to pursue this idea of happiness we were just talking about. And then God is also the supreme judge in the last paragraph that sees the rectitude of our intentions, or put in more simple terms, he sees in our hearts. He knows what we're up to. He sees our intentions. And then at the end, they appeal to a firm reliance on divine providence. It turns out this God actually does intervene sometimes in the affairs of men, and we're going to appeal to it. So there's a theology to this document that strengthens and becomes even stronger as you go through the document. And so, like I said, some people overread it. I think that's a mistake and gets us on the wrong ground. There's a strong argument, which I don't see meaning saying the argument is strong, but it's a very prevalent argument that there's no there. And I think that's incorrect as well. And so one of the reasons this I spend so much time on this theme in the book is to recover, I think, the actual intentions in the through their clearly through their language. I mean, John Witherspoon, the Presbyterian minister, was the chaplain of the Continental Congress. John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress, was a strong Congregationalist. They weren't. There were some. Franklin was pretty deistic, but really the only one. Jefferson has some quirky religious ideas, but was very respectful, and as writer. He then had to recognize all the other opinions in that Continental Congress and the American people. He couldn't get away with making this a secular document. So he writes to his audience, and then the Continental Congress adds those last two references to God I mentioned, which even further underscores the argument. There's a theology in the Declaration.
There's so much more to talk about in this book. So much material. I hardly know where to begin. There are many questions I could ask you about the story that you've set down in this book, which I found enlightening and entertaining on literally every page. But let me shift gears a little bit and ask you a couple of broader questions. As we mentioned earlier, we're nearing the 250th birthday of the United States. How would you assess the current state of American patriotism? And while we're at it, what does it mean to be patriotic? Because in recent decades, many Americans just have come to conflate the word patriotism with jingoism.
Yeah. No, that's a great point as well. I mean, I'll ask him I think we're going to find out. Let's put it that way. This is a unique opportunity. We're going to have this big anniversary. There's going to be a lot of attention, in the media. Local communities are going to be doing things. I mean, I remember very distinctly 1976. Now, I was in middle school, but I remember the trains coming through and the parade, the tall ships. This stuff is really important. And we're going to see what happens here. And I think there's evidence, and we're now seeing it being percolate, that there are a lot of Americans out there, Republicans, Democrats, left and right, kind of, you know, the old, you know, kind of the old liberal types, who think this is actually a pretty good country and are very proud to be in this country. And I mean, look, people all over the world, they want to escape other nations. Where do they go? They want to come here. So I think there is a patriotism out there. I think the problem is it in much of our politics, especially of late, we've kind of beaten down on that. And this goes back to your general question about patriotism. You're right. It's kind of has a bad name today. It's kind of, well, it's kind of chauvinistic and it's not really thoughtful and all this kind of stuff. And I think that's really nonsense. It's patriotism. There's a great conversation in Tocqueville about this. And actually my book begins with a chapter on falling in love with your country again, and defending patriotism. And Tocqueville makes this great distinction between instinctive patriotism, the kind of patriotism we you know get from you know growing up in a community and being a kid and watching this stuff and learning about your grandparents and the local war memorial and all this kind of thing. But at some point it becomes reflective as we become you know kind of reflective individuals thinking about the nature of citizenship and our responsibilities and duties and this kind of thing. And that reflective form of satirism, which is still a form of love, right? Augustine says you can't love something unless you know it. Reflective patriotism is a patriotism that loves our country because we know about it, and it, which is not to say it's perfect in every way, but if when you come to know it and know that it's the principles at its heart, the things towards which we as imperfect people, the thing toward which we aspire is a great thing. These are noble ideas, great truths. And that's what makes America lovely. So I think we will see more patriotism. I think there is a natural patriotism out there among the American people. I think we need to do a better job at defending it. And that's also another reason why I wrote this book, which was to tell them that story again and show them, tell them, this country is worthy of your love.
Let me shift gears yet again, because I'd like to ask you about the 1776 report that you and the 1776 Commission put out, which I've read. That was largely in response to the historical revisionism of the left's 1619 project, wasn't it? Tell us about the 1776 report.
Yeah. I suppose it was generally because that's kind of the time. It wasn't specifically meant to respond, you know, line by line or in particular to say the 1619 project or something else. But it was in the midst of all that to put a marker down. And we knew in at that time, looking down the road, there was going to be this commemoration of the 25th anniversary. So it was intended to put a marker down. And so it makes an argument about what the Declaration, the Constitution, and notes how it's being criticized, and it ought to be defended. And to that extent, the 1776 report, I mean, that's now what, 4, 5, 8, 10 years ago, is kind of a precursor to a lot of the stuff going on now. Kind of carrying that out, which is to say there ought to be a national conversation about our principles, but if you're going to have that national conversation, you need to be honest about it. Now, the report talks about slavery. I mean, you know, when I say honest about it, I like to teach history, warts and all, but don't miss the forest for the trees. You know, understand that history. What were they doing? What were their intentions? The Declaration embeds into the American system the principle which led eventually to the emancipation of those slaves and the end of slavery. It was not intended to command slavery, and thus is the evidence of our systemic slave racism. That's just bad history. It looks backwards. If you're going to study this, go back and learn the history itself. Learn the story. And we have an obligation to understand them. What were they up to? What were they doing? What were they thinking? Read their letters, read their documents. It's all there. It's very clear. It's not that difficult. And again, I've this book is really meant to be a general reader's book. It's not complicated. It's not an academic book. It doesn't require a lawyer to understand this stuff. Read their own remarks. I use almost exclusively original sources. Let them tell their own story, or as I did here, let the Declaration tell its own story. That's my request.
Yes. My wife and I homeschool our kids, and I've actually just undertaken an American history course with my two older girls. There's so much great material in your book to share with them. Do you have any recommendations? You have any recommendations about what parents can do to fill in the gaps in what is currently taught in schools about civics and American history?
I agree and recognize the problem you've raised here. Gaps need to be filled. I would generally say that one of the most important things a parent can do for their child is give them a love of reading. When it comes to American history, you know, we think of civics, and there's kind of this formal sense of civics. Well, you need to learn about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and you know. Yes, that is true. But first, what you need to do is give them a love of reading and a love of story, and then guide them towards good biography. You know, and when they're young, these are very simple biographies. They're childhood biographies, meaning biographies written for younger readers. About the great figures, Washington and Jefferson and John Adams and the American Revolution, all of these things, get them on that track, because I know in my case, in that example I gave about the move from instinctive to reflective patriotism, you start with the instinctive. They want to hear the story, the excitement of it. And then guide them along a path to deepen that understanding through better education. Then you can turn to books that are more substance. You know, my book this book I just did on the Declaration or things like that. But don't overwhelm them with the technical stuff first. You got to approach it the way their minds are going to approach it, which is. First, through the excitement and the interest, and capture their interest. I loved history and the stories of history. Only later then did I study the ideas behind it. And now I tell those stories because that's the way you get into the mind.
Well, that's great advice, and I couldn't agree more about the importance of inculcating a love of reading and the importance of stories. So that's good to know. Let me ask you a couple of quick final questions. Are you working on something now? And also, how can people best keep up with what you're doing?
That's a great question. I'm always working on things. My main work right now is actually centered around America, the 250th anniversary. I'm a technical advisor for the there's a White House task force, and there's a group called a Freedom 250, which is producing a lot of the big events and things. There are going to be some freedom trucks that Freedom 250 is created, six of them traveling all over the country. And I was involved in the creation of that, the writing of that story. So I've been involved in that. Obviously, I'm working on this current book. I'd probably say my next project is I've done a number of things on Washington in particular. And I want to write a book on him in the context of the Revolution, and again, from that story point of view that actually then draws in the more substantive elements of what he actually accomplished, which I think they're great, and I think we actually kind of downplay him in many ways. He's this heroic figure and all this kind of idea in our mind, but what he actually did was quite remarkable. The best way to track my work is to go to hillsdale.edu. I'm at the graduate school, and I'm based in Washington, D.C. Just look out for my writings.
So. Yes, that's good to know. Well, I'm looking forward to the Washington book. He's a personal hero of mine, and I've got a massive shelf full of biographies, so I'm looking forward to adding yours to it. Matthew Spaulding, thanks so much for coming to the Right Take podcast. Keep up the great work.
It's been great talking to you. It's a wonderful conversation, and thank you for having me.
Listeners, make sure you get The Making of the American Mind. It will make you fall in love with America all over again. And thank you for tuning in. As always, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.